from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Joelle Hezboutros.
And I'm Dylan Okabe-Jowdat.
This week on War News Radio, Reclaiming Identities.
First, we hear from Swarthmore alumnus David Kennedy about the impact of the criminal justice system on social norms.
Next, we explore the recent evolution of Iraqi art and culture with New York University professor Sinan Antoun.
Finally, we present our editorial segment, Filibusted.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
The Sultan of Brunei has announced the country will enforce Sharia law, marking the first East Asian nation to adopt the controversial penal code. Under the first phase of the new laws, citizens of Brunei face conviction by Islamic courts for offenses such as pregnancy out of wedlock and failure to perform Friday prayers. Phase two of the laws reportedly include the introduction of flogging, amputation, and death by stoning. The announcement was met with much protest from human rights organizations. Muslim ethnic Malays, who make up the majority of the population, are said to be largely in support of the changes. Yet many citizens are concerned by the increasing religious conservatism and have taken to social media to voice their criticism.
Three people were killed and 79 injured in a terrorist attack outside a train station in the Xinjiang region of western China. The event coincides with the end of Chinese President Xi Jinping's four-day visit to the region. Little has been released regarding the identity of the assailants, armed with explosives and knives, but Chinese analysts say the attack may be the work of militant Uyghur separatists who seek to establish an autonomous state of East Turkestan. Uyghurs, an ethnic Turkic and predominantly Muslim group, make up approximately half of Xinjiang's 22 million residents. This group, which has had a historically violent relationship with the Han Chinese, claims to be victims of the government's political oppression and economic discrimination. These sectarian tensions were the focus of President Xi's visit, and he has since urged, quote, decisive actions to intensify efforts aimed at combating separatists.
This week marks Iraq's first national parliamentary election since the United States withdrew its troops in 2011. With over 9,000 candidates seeking 328 seats in parliament, no party is expected to win a majority. This necessitates the formation of a coalition government, which could take months after the election. Shia Islamist Party, State of Law, the most prominent political party of current Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, is expected to perform best in the elections. Despite the massive security operation in place to protect voters, roadside bombs, targeted attacks, and suicide bombs continue to prevent Iraqis from voting. While over 50 attacks on polling stations and voters throughout Iraq have been reported, approximately 60% of Iraq's eligible voters participated in the elections.
Shootouts claimed the lives of 14 people in the Mexican city of Reynosa, where assailants opened fire on federal police officers. Among the 14 dead were 10 gunmen, 2 federal authorities, and 2 bystanders. Reynosa is located in the northern Mexican state of Tamaulipas, an area which has experienced a constant stream of drug-related violence in the last month, leaving 64 dead. In response, Mexico's government promised a new strategy to combat the violence, but has yet to provide further details. Drug violence in Mexico has claimed more than 85,000 deaths since 2007, when the former president Felipe Calderón ordered the Mexican military to engage the cartels.
At least 15 were killed and 19 wounded following clashes in the southern Philippines this week. The violence broke out after militants from the Abu Sayyaf group launched a surprise attack on Philippine Marines in an attempt to recapture their base camp from the government. The Abu Sayyaf group has been classified as a terrorist organization by the United States since 2002 and has ties to the Al-Qaeda network. The recent incident is the latest in a string of violent encounters between the military and armed groups. This recent incident is the latest in a string of violent encounters between the military and armed groups. Much of the violence has centered around a peace pact between the government and a larger Muslim rebel group, the Moro Islamist Liberation Front. Despite the peace deal, many smaller rebel groups, including Abu Sayyaf, have continued to fight with the goal of establishing an autonomous Islamist state in the southern portion of the country.
A Syrian government-launched missile destroyed a school in Aleppo, killing 18 children, according to United Kingdom-based human rights group, the Syrian Observatory. Video footage of the classroom after the attack shows the remaining walls and floor splattered with blood, along with the remains of a local student art exhibition. The United Nations Children's Fund released a statement condemning the recent indiscriminate attacks led by the Syrian government that have maimed and killed dozens of children. In a televised appearance, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and his wife Asma met with parents whose only sons were killed in the attack.
This is War News Radio. What if criminal justice had a Hippocratic Oath? Swarthmore alumnus David M. Kennedy from the class of 1980 tackles that very question in a recent talk he gave on campus about the ways in which the U.S. criminal justice system makes crime worse in urban centers across the country. By locking up entire communities, Kennedy argues that police have damaged the social norms that keep neighborhoods healthy and safe. Instead, Kennedy presents some alternative strategies and creative solutions for a new, and better, applied ethics of crime control. War News Radio's Patrick Hahn reports.
I have lots and lots and lots of black friends and colleagues of all walks. They are cops, they are prosecutors, they are judges, they are gang members, they are drug dealers, they are my colleagues, they are my friends. And I have never, ever spoken to one of my black friends and said, do you know any dead people? Do you know any homicide victims in your life, in your family, in your social relationships? And had any one of them say no.
That was David Kennedy, Swarthmore alum from the class of 1980, at a recent talk on campus entitled, What If Criminal Justice Had a Hippocratic Oath? Toward an Applied Ethics of Crime Control. He directed the Boston Gun Project, whose Operation Ceasefire intervention was responsible for more than 60% reduction in youth homicide victimization. The author of Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and The End of Violence in Inner City America. He also directs the Center for Crime Prevention and Control at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. In this particular talk, Kennedy focuses on the ways in which the U.S. criminal justice system has created a culture that seeks to imprison entire urban communities in the name of protecting them.
I work in places where all the men have gone to prison. I have a colleague at John Jay, Ernest Drucker, who has just published a very fine book called A Plague of Prisons. And in the first chapter, it says that if you are a black man in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., your lifetime likelihood that you will be arrested and at least spend a term in jail is now approaching 100%. One of my black preacher friends said to me once, if you want to destroy a civilization, lock it up.
Through mass incarceration, the criminal justice system erodes the healthy norms that keep a community safe and instead creates norms of non-cooperation with police.
Communities where too many people go to prison stop doing the things that healthy communities do to protect themselves against crime. Healthy communities say to each other, there are things we do here, there are things we do not do here, that is not okay, do not do that thing here. And when the law and the police are an oppressive force, people stop doing that. They stop producing what the sociologists call collective efficacy. They do not work together. They do not join with the criminal justice system. They will not tell who did what. They will not testify. They will not convict. Stop snitching is not witness intimidation. Stop snitching is mostly the growing norm in these neighborhoods, that the police are the enemy and good people do not deal with the police.
In this way, incarceration of young black males becomes normalized for these communities.
And this black grandmother came forward and said, I have a story for you. I was talking to my six-year-old grandson not that long ago, and he said to me, Grandma, when I grow up and go to prison, I'm going to.
Kennedy makes a radical proposal that policymakers take the same oath that medical doctors do, to first do no harm.
And so my first principle is first do no harm. What does that mean? Well, it means let's stop trying to protect communities by locking up everybody in them.
According to Kennedy, the current state of affairs for urban communities is pretty bleak and only getting worse in many cases. He points out, for instance, that there were about 300,000 Americans in prison when he started his work in the 1980s. And today?
2.3 million people behind bars in the United States. It's one in every 100 adults in the country. It's something like one in 18 young black men. If you are a black male born today, you stand a 1 in 3 chance of going to prison during your lifetime. We are doing this as a matter of national policy.
Yet to Kennedy, the grossest injustice is that the criminal justice system is not only not helping, it is actually making things worse.
We now know that it makes crime worse. When you damage the fabric of those communities in this way, things fall apart. And places where things have fallen apart are breeding grounds for crime and violence.
So how do we stop making things worse? According to Kennedy, the first step is to stop treating these communities with what he calls profound disrespect.
And guys who have been doing the wrong things for the right reasons their entire careers are beginning to say in public, we go into these places, we stop everything that moves, we turn everybody upside down, we shake them. If crack comes out of their pocket, we carry them away. If it doesn't, we put them back on their feet and we send them away. These are neighborhoods where the young men can't walk down the street without getting stopped, their mothers get pulled over, their pastors get pulled over. They are treated with profound disrespect. I said, I don't know any black people who don't have dead friends. If I ask them, I don't know any black people who haven't been profiled.
Secondly, Kennedy advises us to stop, quote, lying as a national policy.
Every time we say to somebody standing in front of us in court, next time, young man, I'm going to come down on you like a ton of bricks, and it never happens, we are teaching them that we are idiots and nothing we say should be trusted.
To Kennedy, doing no harm is better than what we have now, but it doesn't improve the current situation. So how do we change things for the better? First and foremost, Kennedy proposes that we must support the natural capabilities of the community.
Safe communities are not safe because there's a cop on every corner and everybody's afraid of the feds. Safe communities are safe because there is a strong civic sense that there are things we do here, things we do not do here, and when people cross that line, the community takes action.
His second cutting-edge solution is the custom notification system.
As a published, academically validated deterrence theorist, I will tell you that the rule of deterrence is mom today trumps a 20% chance of the feds in 5 years, which means even more that we should not silence the mothers and grandmothers and elders and pastors of communities by treating them like felons so they hate us and will not stand with us.
Kennedy argues that every time we can do this, we should, because the community has more standing with the guy on the street than any police officer will. Kennedy acknowledges that these more targeted approaches will not always work. Even then, he points out that backlash against police is often not because of the penalty itself, but a result of procedural injustice.
It is not about what happens to you. It's not about whether you get the ticket or get arrested or go to jail. It is about how you are treated during that process. It is what the academics call procedural justice. And what matters turns out to be, have you been treated with respect? Does it seem like what you are doing, what is being done to you, is motivated by those people having your best interests in mind? And do you have a chance to speak your piece?
According to Kennedy, it's not about the outcome, it's about the engagement. And as long as we subject urban communities to procedural injustice, we're systematically undercutting legitimacy. For example, Kennedy claims that the recent New York City mayor won the election because of his promise to bring in a new police commissioner that would abolish stop and frisk, a procedurally problematic practice.
Even if you believe what the city said, which is it was effective and it was legal, let's just give them that. They can have it. The community hated it, the city hated it, and they threw the bums out.
Though his innovative crime control methods have yielded results and revolutionized police practices, Kennedy suffers from no illusions when they don't work. The first line of defense is what he calls deterrence.
We are doing this in all kinds of ways. We're sitting down guys with gun records and saying, you need to understand that if you get caught again, they are talking about you at the U.S. Attorney's Office and you face at least a 5-year federal mandatory minimum. The future offending for the guys who have just that intervention goes down dramatically.
When that doesn't work, the next step is using the least amount of force possible. Kennedy argues that we should economize by treating arrests the way we treat our own money.
And the idea, which is still embedded, especially in police culture and prosecutorial culture, that an arrest is a good thing, doesn't matter whether it solves the problem, doesn't matter whether it has an impact. It's an outcome measure. We want that as high as we possibly can. This is what happened with stop and frisk in New York.
Kennedy states that we must avoid seeing stop and frisk and other impact measures as a good thing. Rather, he asserts that we should take presumption of innocence more seriously.
We should presume that every application of state power is a mistake until we can prove otherwise.
Lastly, Kennedy proposes that we use network science to minimize the amount of arrests necessary to prevent crimes.
You can do the link analysis, you can do the mathematical analysis on that network, and you can figure out the minimal number of those connectors that need to be taken out, at which point the entire network is no longer a network, it is not an entity any longer, and it cannot function. And what would have been an arrest of 50 people can come down to an arrest of 5 people, or 7 people, or 12 people.
All in all, despite these innovative techniques, Kennedy affirms that change must ultimately come from the communities themselves, not from the outside.
When somebody in Gary McCarthy and Eric Holder's position is willing to go to communities and say, we have been part of this problem, it is not your fault. We have helped bring us to this sorry pass at which we find ourselves. That opens the door to say something equally important to the community, which is simply that no community can set standards. Nobody can set standards for a community from the outside.
So how do you build legitimacy?
In communities where people don't trust the police, it is doubly important for the community to set clear standards. One of my other minister friends says, when the law has lost its standing, it's more important to say something's wrong than to say it's illegal, and that's right.
For War News Radio, I'm Patrick Hahn.
This is War News Radio. Common narratives of culture in Iraq often follow a path of sectarian violence or Mesopotamian history. What these simplistic interpretations obscure that has shaped Iraq's recent literary and artistic landscape. In a public lecture, Sinan Antoun builds on theories of Iraqi culture and explains the impact of Iraq's history on its art and culture. War News Radio's Dylan Okabe Jaudat reports.
Iraq, as it stands today, is popularly portrayed in two ways. The first is a country that suffered under the rule of Saddam Hussein and was subsequently devastated by American invasion in 2003. The second highlights the region's ancient roots, harkening back to Babylon and Mesopotamia. The issue with the first depiction lies in attributing Iraq's decline solely to the American invasion in 2003. This disregards the damage done to Iraqi culture by British colonial rule and United Nations sanctions. Although well-meaning, the second depiction is that of a monolith and overlooks the value of contemporary Iraqi culture. New York University professor Sinan Antoun's writing and research focus on contemporary Arab literature and politics, as well as Iraqi history. This month, he spoke at a public lecture at Swarthmore College. His story of the disintegration of Iraqi culture begins with the socialist Ba'ath Party overthrow of the 50-year rule of the Hashemite monarchy in Iraq.
Now, in 1973, the nationalization of oil in Iraq and the rise of oil prices allowed the second Ba'ath regime to gradually extend its control to all aspects of Iraqi life and culture, and for Saddam to later construct his totalitarian edifice. The program of the so-called Ba'athification of culture was implemented, and intellectuals, writers, and artists were enticed, if not forced, to join the ranks of the Ba'ath or face a familiar fate. Death, prison, or exile. Cultural institutions were purged of all of those who were perceived to be enemies of the Ba'ath. I mention this because its culmination was the exodus of hundreds of Iraqi writers and intellectuals in the late 70s, and especially in 1978, to Arab and European capitals. This was a very important and constitutive event of the Iraqi cultural diaspora, which will have other waves later. These exiled writers and intellectuals were to enrich Arab cultural life, especially in Beirut, with their contributions. But some of them suffered a great deal of isolation and marginalization as well for being opposed to the Ba'ath and the war against Iran later. With the 1979 assumption of full power by Saddam Hussein and the beginning of the eight-year war against Iran, the personality cult and the aestheticization of violence became the predominant norm in Iraqi culture and society. Very few exceptions. While already moving in that direction, literary and cultural production in all of its forms was now to be fully at the service of the battle being waged against the evil enemy. Dissent, criticism, or hints thereof were unpatriotic and treasonous. All writing was to be mobilizational and geared towards the glorification of the commander and of Iraqi heroism in battle. Saddam Hussein's famous slogan, "The gun and the pen have one and the same barrel," which was usually printed on publications and written on walls of cultural institutions, put it succinctly and ominously.
Most literary and cultural outlets had fallen prey to the artistic interests of the Ba'ath regime. Beginning in 1969 with the installment of the regime, artists and writers were encouraged to celebrate the ancient territorial roots of Iraqi culture through their work. It was during this time that festivals such as the Babylonian International Festival, held in a reconstructed Hellenistic theater, first took place. When Hussein rose to power and his personality cult took hold, art forms and public displays became imbued with his image. The most widely known example of this being the Ferdows Square statue of Saddam Hussein, erected in 2002 and eventually toppled by an American tank shortly after the US invasion of Iraq in 2003.
When the war with Iran came to an end in 1988, Iraq was already burdened with more than $80 billion of debt. Massive socioeconomic problems and an army of a million men whose reintegration into society was proving to be difficult. The brief respite Iraqis enjoyed from war ended in August 1990 with Saddam's invasion and occupation of Kuwait. This was followed by a series of UN resolutions and a severe economic embargo designed to force Saddam to withdraw from Kuwait. When the embargo did not prove successful, the so-called Desert Storm operation started with a massive bombing and systematic destruction of Iraq's infrastructure. By all accounts, the economic sanctions forced on Iraq were the most severe in modern history. Again, all of this information is important because it will contribute to the erosion of the social fabric and the destruction of all of these institutions slowly.
The 1990s sanctions resulted in an exodus of educated Iraqis, many of whom were artists. These refugees fled to areas in Scandinavia, the United Kingdom, and the United States, among other regions. Many refugee writers began telling their stories in newly acquired languages, and often translated between Arabic and the language of their host country. Of course, language is just one of the many barriers refugees and asylum seekers face in adjusting to their new home. The kinds of obstacles that refugees are presented with also depend upon the places in which they end up.
Diaspora is a general term, of course, and the level of acclimation and assimilation varies greatly depending on the host country and its own experience or availability of institutions to integrate refugees. For example, some would be surprised that Iraqi writers and authors living in Scandinavian countries are thriving, but Iraqi writers who came to this country had a very difficult path.
A profile from the Migration Policy Institute reports that Sweden, the largest Scandinavian country by population size, has been receptive to immigrants since the end of World War II. The same report indicates that just over 70,000 Iraqi refugees were granted Swedish citizenship in 2004. Department of Homeland Security data indicate that under 2,000 Iraqi refugees and asylees were granted lawful permanent residency status in that same year. For those that chose to remain in Iraq, or those that were unable to leave during the American occupation of 2003, the security situation was dire. Professor Antun describes the impossibility of continuing in one's profession during war.
In addition to that, of course, the lack of security and the violence and the assassinations make it very difficult for anyone who's trying to be independent to practice. Hundreds of university professors were assassinated, but most importantly, a number of intellectuals, such as Hadi Mehdi, who's a playwright, who had his own radio station and was criticizing the sectarian parties, was assassinated in his own house. Kamil Shia, another Iraqi intellectual who came back to Iraq, was assassinated. Anyone who strays from the party line of their party or of their sect faces very obvious danger. But in this environment, structurally, it is almost impossible to be independent.
Yet, a handful of art organizations in Iraq persist. Professor Antun mentions two publishing companies, films produced by Iraqis, and organizations that teach Iraqis to make their own art. He highlights the work of Iraqi poet Sargon Boulis, who left the country in 1967. In his poetry, Boulis captures an image of the military evolution of Iraq without excessive nostalgia. Professor Antun reads Boulis's poem entitled, I Came From Here.
One poem where the figure of the ghost appears, and to just say a few things about it. There are two, as I call them, ghost poems, in which the primary figure is a ghost, and they represent two encounters with victims of two monumental events. One of them is the war, and the other is the sanctions. I will actually move on to the one about the sanctions, because it speaks to the issue of the diaspora, in a way. This is dedicated to an Iraqi short story writer who died in the 90s in the sanctions, and Boulis imagines an encounter with him. The poem is called I Came to You From There. The end of the year of endings, the weather and the crows, a tightness in my breathing from smoking too much, some illness, loneliness, worrying, or visceral pain, knocked me down and I roamed the empty town, crossed over to that particular corner where he met me face to face just before nightfall. It was my friend, the short story writer himself, but something had emptied his eyes of that light. It was my humorous old friend himself, but something had overturned his features from the inside. The eyebrows are white, the teeth black. When he smiles, not out of happiness, he looks like he's crying. Beyond sadness, as if in an undeveloped photograph, and here this issue of representation comes in, as if in a burning photograph which would collapse with a simple touch. He met me as we were getting out of a storm that had started yesterday, whipping walls with restaurant and shop signs, making telephone cables really weep in that empty square. I cried, Yusuf, Yusuf, what happened to your face? Yusuf, what have they done to your eyes? By God, what have they done to your eyes? He said, please don't ask. It's obliteration. He said, I came from there. Not me. No, I am not myself. Not you. No, you are not yourself. They and the gods of Zakum, they and the master of death standing at the door. The refugees are on the roads, the children are in coffins, the women are wailing in the squares. Your family is fine. They send you their best from cemeteries. Baghdad is a spike of grain covered with locusts. I came to you from there. It is obliteration, he said. Then walked away and disappeared everywhere. And that last line is quite important and haunting.
Professor Antoun insists that the figure described in the poem does not return to Iraq, but flees the country to continue to spread the messages of the deceased. For War News Radio, I'm Dylan Okabe-Jaudat.
This is War News Radio. Sometimes it's hard to read the news without getting angry. Caroline Batten and Jay Clayton have stopped trying. War News Radio proudly presents Filibusted, an editorial segment dedicated to news that makes us tear our hair out.
We at Filibusted have a list of usual suspects when it comes to mockery of international affairs.
If there's a story about an incompetent megalomaniac, it's probably Kim Jong-un. If there's a story about Bond supervillains, it's probably Vladimir Putin.
But sometimes it just feels like we lack one quintessential villainous archetype, the mustache-twirling capitalist.
Fortunately, that ends today.
The United States and the European Union have enacted sanctions on Russia for, you know, seizing a sovereign country's territory when they annexed Crimea.
It's hard to imagine anyone advocating for a smaller-scale response. Unless your name is Vladimir and you ride shirtless on horseback.
Or, apparently, if you've invested a lot of money in Russia. A group of top U.S. companies and European energy firms want to limit sanctions against Russia, saying they're concerned about the stability of global markets.
You mean they're concerned about their profits?
Well, no, let's be fair. Leading executives at the German-based chemical company BASF say that these sanctions could raise energy prices in Europe or even around the globe. And if that weren't scary enough, the U.S.-Russia Business Council warns that U.S. and European banks with Russian loans could be at risk.
But this is the U.S.-Russia Business Council. I'm sensing a bit of a bias.
Even better, one of the loudest voices lobbying against sanctions is the energy company Gazprom, which is 50% owned by the Russian government.
I'm starting to notice a pattern here. But come on, even major corporations aren't that sleazy. No company would just come right out and say that international law is less important than their business profits, right?
Of course not. In fact, let's look at PepsiCo's 2012 annual report, that part where they talk about diplomacy in the future. Quote, particularly in Russia, as a result of economic and political conditions, our financial performance could be adversely affected.
Oh.
Look, we know that big business gotta do what big business gotta do. They've invested in Russia to make money, and now they're worried they're not going to make as much money.
And being in bed with Vladimir Putin and the United States and the European Union is pretty much par for the course.
So we don't begrudge companies for trying to save their profits.
But when one of your major trade partners annexes part of Ukraine in the first land grab of a European country since World War II, and your response is to tell both sides to just chill out, then maybe it's time to take a step back.
There are plenty of other countries you can invest in that haven't just totally messed up domestic diplomacy. For example, China's an economic powerhouse, and they're not in the news this week, right?
Well, actually...
Oh no.
In a particularly bewildering move, Beijing has recently banned outdoor kebab barbecues from its streets.
Kebab stands are run mostly by members of China's Uyghur community, a Muslim minority group that faces pretty overt discrimination. Things like job postings with "No Uyghurs Wanted" printed on them.
So Uyghur rights advocates are saying this is a pretty transparent move to kick Uyghur workers out of Beijing.
Now, we at Filibusted don't like to point fingers.
Are you kidding? That's our favorite activity.
But Beijing isn't even trying that hard to cover up its blatant racism. Their excuse for banning the barbecues? They cause too much air pollution.
Yep. Beijing is trying to convince the world that its air pollution problems are caused by too many kebabs.
Smog from the city of Beijing reaches the California coast. It literally kills trees on Japanese islands. And you're worried about Muslim snack food?
Forget Greenpeace's report on the smoke released by Beijing's coal refineries. Forget the carcinogenic formaldehyde used in city buildings. It's all about the grilled lamb.
Blaming Beijing's air pollution problems on barbecue smoke is like saying North Korea's food shortage is due to Kim Jong-un's love for cake.
One fat tyrant's passion for food can't reduce an entire country to starvation.
Even if his repressive laws, failed economic policies, and aggressive isolationism can.
But speaking of Kim's appetite, France, at long last, has foiled his quest for snacks.
Kim sent three North Korean cheese experts to a prestigious French cheese-making school to learn how to make him his favorite Emmental cheese.
They didn't get in. France's cheese diplomacy is notoriously hard line, after all.
This is going to be a serious blow to our favorite lunatic dictator. According to The Telegraph, he's, quote, dissatisfied with North Korea's current dairy products.
I can think of several other things about North Korea to be dissatisfied about. Like the fact that it's the world's most corrupt country, according to Transparency International. Or that the country scored an alarming on the 2010 Global Hunger Index. But hey, Kim's never exactly been good at prioritizing. Remember last year when his top national project was building a personal ski resort?
Yep. Masikryong. Apparently, it's up and running. Although, according to The Guardian, it's sitting there totally empty, like something out of The Shining.
Here's Kimmy!
Well, I'll never get that image out of my head.
Kim was so intent on getting his ski resort built that he urged the entire country to operate at Masikryong speed.
But now that the resort is finally finished, it sounds like he's out of ideas for different speeds his subjects can operate at.
He's now celebrating International Workers' Day by telling North Koreans to operate at Chosun speed, which just means Korea speed.
Aside from making Kim sound like a sci-fi action hero, we're not exactly sure what Chosun speed achieves.
Kim's enthusiasm for International Workers' Day, which is about showing support for oppressed labor movements, is already hilarious.
What are you talking about? North Korea is all about freeing laborers from oppression. When the global proletariat sings the International, they're thinking about Kim Jong-un.
I don't even know how to respond to that.
Great summary. For Filibusted, I'm Jay Clayton. Thanks to our producer, Nithya Swaminathan.
And I'm Caroline Batten, signing off for the last time before graduation. As always, it's been a pleasure. At least for us.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Anissa Andrabi, Nora Balin, Anita Desai, Sabrina Merrill, Asma Nore, Nithya Swaminathan, Tyler Welsh, Zoe Werbin, and Chloe Wittenberg. Our piece editors are Jay Clayton, Sadie Rittman, and Chloe Wittenberg. I'm Joelle Hajboutros.
And I'm Dylan Okave-Jowdat. Until next time, thanks for listening.